метро Санкт-Петербурга на станциях Синая технологический институт Синяя.
Сработало взрывное устройство.
И очевидцев взрыв прогремел не на платформе, а в
вестибюле станции. Сильно задымлен, двери вагона искорежены.
На официальном уровне случившийся терактом.
Первую помощь раненым оказывали.
So terror has struck again in Russia. It struck in Vladimir Putin's hometown of St. Petersburg, which until now had been immune from the attacks that have plagued Moscow and other cities. It struck while Putin was in town, holding talks with Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. And it struck at a time when the Kremlin is desperate to change the subject following massive demonstrations against official corruption. So, what happens now? What happens after the bombs? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded and where he is still keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Здравствуйте.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Welcome back to the podcast, Don.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, or good afternoon from where I sit. Well, from the 2002 Nordos theater siege in Moscow to the 2004 Beslan school massacre to the 2013 bus and train station bombings in Volgograd, the Kremlin has treated terrorist acts as opportunities to consolidate power and stifle dissent. Following the Ordnance siege, new press restrictions were placed in the media. In the aftermath of Beslan, the Kremlin eliminated the direct election of governors, and after the Volgograd bombings, the authorities tightened controls of the internet. Power was consolidated, dissent was suppressed, and yet terrorism has continued. And there are signs that we'll soon see more of the same. Speaking on Channel 1 just after Monday's bombing, ultra-nationalist Alexander Parkhanov said the attack, the March 26 nationwide protest against corruption, and the report by opposition figure Alexei Navalny exposing corruption were all part of a campaign to weaken Russia. Yuri Shvitkin, the deputy chair of the State Duma's Defense Committee, has proposed placing a moratorium on public protests, and another lawmaker, Vitaly Milonov, is introducing legislation that would ban online calls for unsanctioned demonstrations and require all social media users to register with their passport data. The Kremlin, meanwhile, encouraged regional leaders to organize a series of anti-terror demonstrations this week. It seems the Kremlin is pulling out the old post-terrorism playbook again. But it's a double-edged sword. As Vyedomosti warned in an editorial this week, with Russia becoming a target of choice for jihadists, terrorism could pierce the Kremlin's carefully crafted aura of competence and omnipotence. Mark, how does this look from Moscow as you're sitting there? How is this playing out this week?
Well, obviously, it's interesting because there was a sort of huge upwelling of public dismay after the actual attack. And I wouldn't really want to overplay this element of the sort of Kremlin using it. I mean, firstly, because frankly, in any system, politicians seek to sort of use such developments for their own advantage. But secondly, because you also had Volodin explicitly saying this is not something that should be used for sort of to sanction some wider crackdown.
And we all believe everything Volodin says.
Well, actually, I mean, in a way, part of his job as Duma wrangler does mean that he's meant to be there to actually sort of put the line, because now if what happens goes against that, it undercuts his authority, and you know he's not going to just set that on the cuff. But I think looking more broadly, obviously there's been the immediate increase in security. I mean, you see a lot more police out on the streets, sniffer dogs, bag checks, particularly, it has to be said, of people of darker than the average complexion. And that's as much as anything else about public reassurance and just demonstrating an act. The question is precisely, well, what's the long-term strategy going to be? Because you're absolutely right that there's, you know, lots of these elements of the usual playbook, some big protests, some big grand statements and so forth. The thing is, politically, Yes, how do you talk up the threat without undermining your own claim to be the regime that brings stability and security to ordinary Russians, especially in the run-up to 2018? And in security terms, it really has emphasized one crucial point, which is that the Federal Security Service and the other agencies do not have a handle on what is going on within the Central Asian migrant and unregistered migrant communities. These are areas that are pretty much terra oscura. For so long, they focused on the North Caucasus. They focused on political issue, you know, sort of political opposition. And the lack of intelligence is something that is really quite striking.
Don, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with both of what you guys are saying. Two of the things that struck me about this, I guess I would put the truckers stuff in the group too, is that the regime has the capacity still to be surprised. And I think despite the fact that they do tighten the screws every time an incident like that happens, they clearly are not in control of everything, as Mark said, and that it makes them very nervous. I think the bombing last night in Syria by the U.S. makes them nervous because they're not fully in control of the policy-making political space, and they act like it, as you said. They're simply not, and this capacity to surprise, I think, is really, really unnerving to a lot of people at the top.
Would you agree with Mark's assessment that in contrast to previous attacks and going back to Beslan and Nordost, when they always tended to use this for political advantage after the fact, that do we expect not to see this time?
Well, I think they probably will. I think Putin doesn't want to have a crisis go to waste. And I think they probably will. The question really is the system so advanced in its whatever decay or so it's so complicated now that they can't do that. And I do have serious questions about whether they control events to the extent that they can, even if they were far more efficient than, as Mark correctly said, than they are now.
Let me just pick up on that,
ahead,
if
Mark.
I can. I mean, in terms of the sort of use, look, there's a difference between general, as it were, political use, which is absolutely what I can expect to happen. Which is precisely to be using this as a chance to say, you know, is this really the time for public protest, for example? I mean, it's a great reason to not allow further demonstrations, because you say, we're worried. We're worried about the poor demonstrators. A big concentration of people becomes a terrorist, you know, potential terrorist target, and we can do this in the interests of public safety. So there's all kinds of ways in which you can use it.
Yet they're not worried about the anti-terrorist demonstrations that also could be used that way, right?
I mean, you know, if we're really going to be shocked by politicians being hypocrites, then absolutely, you know, we really need to worry.
Continue your thought.
The question thing is actually whether or not the state currently sort of, you know, has laws and such like that it really wants to pass, which it hasn't been able to pass beforehand. I mean, I think actually if one looks back at earlier ones, there was a genuine sense of loopholes that they had identified, and this is a great opportunity to do so. I'm not getting a feeling that, you know, that for example, the security agencies are hankering after, for example, more control of more registration of social media, because in some ways they want there to be a certain amount of social media chatter because they monitor it and track it. So, I mean, I think that there's that two things. Do I expect that we're going to see concrete measures coming out of this that the government really wants? I think not. But are we going to see it obviously spun for political purpose? Absolutely.
Well, yeah. I mean, when this happened, I mean, the timing was actually quite good for this regime because it does change the conversation. And that seems to be what they want to try to do out of this. Well, what are your thoughts, Don?
Yes, I agree. They are trying to change the conversation. I find the debate about whether things on paper will allow them to crack down a little academic, I can use that expression, because clearly they're nervous, clearly they're interested in tightening the controls, and I think this will spur them in that direction. I'm not sure there will be formal measures on the internet or something else like that, but they don't really need that. I think Mark's comment about monitoring Central Asian developments is very important. I don't think they have a good handle on it. I don't think, as we saw, this was any of the theories this week for the terrorist attack. There were far more broader possibilities which we really haven't thought about before. I mean, Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia, these threats, I thought the regime thought these are areas we were pretty much in control, but they're clearly not. And I think, given the kind of turmoil in the intelligence services as well, they're just not very good at some of this. They're good at some things, but they clearly can't control what's going on.
I mean, one thing I did want to get out of the way very early in this, and all you had to do is look at social media on Monday, and all the predictable allegations that this was a false flag were out there. There is no indication whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned, that it was. And I trust the two of you would agree with that. But this does point to something that I think is rather important, the degree to which this regime has lost trust. Nobody believes that they do anything on the up and up right now. And if there was a terrorist attack went at a time when it could be potentially advantageous for the Kremlin to change the conversation, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people immediately, to the point where there were a lot of journalists who I would say are not friends of the Kremlin, were taking to social media and telling people, cut it out. You know, this is not the time to talk about this. And there's no evidence to suggest this. But yet this does point to a bit of a loss of trust, wouldn't you say, Mark?
Well, I mean, when you say lots of people were saying this false flag, I mean, primarily that was coming from outside of Russia. And yes, of course, there are other people. Yeah, but mainly this was an outsider thing where actually, obviously, the debate has become ludicrously polarized. And it all depends on, in a way, who happens to be in our Twitter feed and who do we happen to sort of see, just as there are others for whom, I mean, again, just take as an example, and we're going to be talking afterwards about the American strikes on Syria. But, you know, I wrote something about that. And immediately I got people saying, what? You're taking it for granted that the Syrians were behind that before there's been an investigation? Which the answer is, of course, yes. Right. But again, you know, there are some people who are just as ridiculously resolute on the other side. Within Russia itself, I honestly am not really picking up much of a sense from the very, very limited contacts I've had. I've only been here a few days. But from the limited contacts, I'm not getting any sense that there's a serious view that this is a sort of false flag type operation or anything like that. I think the real issue is twofold. And again, they both speak to lacks of trust in a different way. First of all, you know, a loss of faith in the state's capacity to protect them. And there is a strong sense that that is one of the, you know, primary functions of the state and the primary functions of Putin as father of the state, father of the nation. And the second thing is this whole polarizing factor about what to do about the Central Asians, because, you know, this is one of the sort of great nationalist talking points that Stroy finds a lot of resonance. But the point is, I mean, Russia economically cannot do without these workers. Putin politically cannot alienate the Central Asian states. He's already ruled out on multiple occasions doing anything about the Central Asian workers. And this is one of the interesting areas where actually, for various reasons, Putin is out of step with Russians. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that also will come back to bite him.
One has to wonder when Navalny gets out of jail, whether what he's going to do, because this, again, is the issue that he kind of made his name on early in his career. He's backed off it lately, but I'm very curious to see how Navalny approaches this whole issue when he gets out. Don, what about you? What about the loss of trust? Would you agree with Mark on that?
I think it's very much there. I was going to just make a point which is less directly related to Mark's point, which I agree with. Of course, there's a loss of trust there. What I find is a Prokhanov's reaction. Is that who it was, Brian?
Yeah, it was Prokhanov. Yeah, which I.
But I thought, was that you, Mark, who wrote earlier in the week that it's been noticed that Western sympathy for the terrorist victims was absent? Was that you earlier in the
yes,
week?
Yes, it was.
It was a very interesting point. I thought about it all week, but my point, Mark, I guess would be, yes, you're right. However, at what point does the West have to stop dealing with Russian complexes and this kind of thing? But it was a very interesting point, and I thank you for it, because, yes, the West sympathy was noticeably less. Absolutely.
I found it notable that the mayor of Paris, shortly after Mark's article appeared, announced that the Eiffel Tower would go dark that night in remembrance of the victims. I think the mayor must have read your piece, Mark.
of course, I'm absolutely sure that must be it.
go
back to Don's point. I mean, I agree. I mean, this point about, you know, how long must the West cater to Russian complexes? I mean, on one level, you're absolutely right. But on another level, on a human level, you know, this was a tragedy for these individuals who were innocent victims of both terrorism and indeed the Putinist state. But there is a sort of wider, I mean, one of the things I was trying to couch in the article that I wrote for the Moscow Times was that we should also think of this as realpolitik. That unfortunately, by doing so, we gave the Russian state further ammunition in its campaign to present the West as intrinsically Russophobic. Now, I'm not saying that if we had illuminated every single building in every single capital with the Russian tricolor, immediately the Kremlin would have said, oh my gosh, they love us after all, and we would have all been sort of living happily ever after. But at least we could have denied them a relatively easy, and I must say, you know, from here, really quite heavily sort of rerun propaganda point. You know, there comes a point when actually catering to, if we put it this way, Russian complexes might also be effective form of information warfare.
I mean, there's also a double standard at work there, Mark, though, because I don't seem to recall any Russian buildings lighting up with the colors of the French, Belgian, or other European flags when there have been attacks in Europe.
Yeah, but again, I mean, in a way, you're approaching, I mean, the benchmark should not be we are no worse than the Russians. I'd like to think that the West actually has a rather higher standard.
Fair point.
But secondly, in a way, this is irrelevant. I mean, what I'm trying to say is actually that there is a realpolitik perspective with, as I put it, sort of, you know, feeding the Kremlin so much love it chokes. I'm not necessarily trying to argue it on a sort of moral perspective, though there is also a moral perspective. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to kind of raise the cynical, pragmatic, Machiavellian angle.
What other? Go ahead, Don.
Just a very interesting point. This harkens back for me a little bit to the way that Obama used to diss Putin all the time in a very personal way. And I've often wondered, wouldn't it be better to sort of insincerely treat him as a partner instead of talking about schoolboy hooliganism and stuff like that? But we, as you say, Mark, we have to keep the human tragedy in mind as well. It's just given the reaction sometimes it's very hard.
One thing I wanted to get in here, and one thing that really struck me right from day one, was the muted reaction from Putin himself. One of the first things to come across the wires after the attack was an announcement from the Kremlin that Putin was not changing his schedule. His meeting with Lukashenko would continue as scheduled. Putin made a brief statement, but then in the post meeting press conference, Putin didn't say one word about the attack, which I thought was really, really striking. Moreover, he almost looked annoyed that it had happened. This was my first. This was, to me, was absolute confirmation that you couldn't even consider this a false flag. He looked almost annoyed that it was happening. He did visit the site in the evening, but again, didn't make any remarks. What did you both make of Putin's reaction, Putin's personal reaction?
Well, I mean, my take is, first of all, Putin finds failure contagious. He runs a mile from it. And this was clearly a failure. And what's more, it's a failure, which actually some of the press here pointed out, was that one of the reasons for this, that this attack went through, may well be precisely because the local security and police forces were overstretched, with also having to cope with, even though they had some, you know, and these things usually tend to be quite sort of vague and common, but they'd had some inkling that there was an attack possible. But the point is, they were having to prepare for the Putin-Lukashenko summit, and so many of that, much of their resources were being devoted to that, but it wasn't being devoted to other things. But also, again, I think this is what. Yes, Putin could make generic. This is terrible. We feel for the people, but he tends not to do the touchy-feely stuff. He likes to be able to give the man of action stuff. And what could he say? It wasn't like sort of previous North Caucasus-related attacks, where he could make these, you know, we'll find them and we'll whack them in the outhouse and so forth. He has to tread very, very carefully. Because this was sort of very from the very early point presumed to be a Central Asia-related issue. You know, what can he honestly promise?
Yeah, no, I mean, what it struck me was that he obviously was genuinely surprised by this, and more than a little bit annoyed is what he looked annoyed. I mean, Putin always looks annoyed, but he looked especially annoyed there. Don, what did you make of Putin's reaction?
Yeah, I agree with you. I thought it was subdued, and I hadn't thought of the word annoyance, but I suppose that would do it too. You know, I compared this in my own mind this week to the Nemtsov killing 2 years ago and how he reacted where. I think, Mark, you just said he ran away. Yeah, I think that he doesn't like this kind of thing. And one would hope there was a little more touchy-feely. It would have helped. But, yeah, I thought he was subdued. And I think, you know, he's not a particularly humane character in any way. And so this personal chemistry stuff is he's not good at it at all. And his mind, he was clearly distracted, which was a very important meeting with Lukashenko. So, yeah, I agree. He could have done more. He should have done more.
I mean, the other thing was that it was clear that the whole apparatus, the whole machine didn't have its talking points. And you had Prakhanov going off in one direction on state television. And when I saw that, I was like, is that, you know, are they set? Is that there for a reason? Are they set? No, it looks like it was Prakhanov just going off on his own right now. But because you didn't really have a set thing. The other thing that struck me was Medvedev. After a month of silence after the Navalny report, and after more than a week of silence, after demonstrations that were, quite frankly, ridiculing him and calling for his head, Medvedev said nothing. Nothing except to inform the world that he had gone skiing and posted pictures of him looking ridiculous doing so. Medvedev chooses the day after the attacks to address the Navalny report in the demonstrations. Now, again, this is about changing the conversation. What did you guys read into that?
Yeah, I mean, taking out the trash day. I mean, again, precisely this is the day when nothing else really matters, so you use it to dispense with the stuff that you really would rather people not be thinking about and looking at. Classic,
but why bring it
cynical
up,
politics.
Why bring it up?
Well, he had to at some point. I mean, again, because the very fact that he wasn't actually addressing it, the very fact that, you know, it was being discussed in the Duma. Remember, there was a vote in the Duma about whether to have an investigation. Yes. And okay, only 40-something deputies ended up voting for it, mainly communists. But again, you know, it had become an issue of national politics. He couldn't just rule this out as tittle-tattle from a blogger. You know, and so he had to be able to say, I have responded to this. Mm. Well, you know, in some respect, I mean, this, in some ways, this, I think, more than anything else, was the true cynical use of the bombings. And again, you know, all politicians do use these kind of tactics. But he, you know, his classic political tone deafness, which has been really quite astonishingly visible of late, you know, once again manifested itself in the fact that he, you know, he did so clumsily and so obviously.
And the day before that Duma vote, you recall the Russian press was reporting that that Volodin had basically called on deputies to defend Medvedev against Navalny's attacks. This was leaked, I believe, intentionally to Kommersant. Don, what did you make of Medvedev?
I thought, as you said, completely politically tone deaf. I mean, skiing, come on.
But I mean, the day after, but choosing to respond to Navalny the day after the attacks.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. He picked it to change the topic and take out the trash, as Mark said, in a way that people wouldn't notice as much.
Now, one other thing.
Brian, the delay was shocking in itself since the first report came out.
It was a month. I mean, it was a month. He didn't say a word for a month. I mean, I could see if that report didn't get any legs, him just ignoring it and hoping. But once that report had legs, and once it brought, you know, tens of thousands of people to the streets across Russia, yeah, there was still another week of silence from him. But then the day after the bombing, he comes out.
Exactly.
One other thing I did want to hit on before we move into the second half and look at the international events and repercussions of this, the issue of the returning jihadists, a growing threat. I mean, there was quite a bit in the media this week about how Russia is becoming a target of choice for jihadists as a result of Syria, and it's becoming a target of opportunity as jihadists return to Russia from Syria. Is this going to kick up the terrorism threat in Russia another notch? Mark, what do you think? You addressed this a bit in a piece earlier this week as well.
Yeah, I think this is really the nightmare, and to be honest, it's a nightmare that the FSB has been living with really since 2015. In the initial period when jihadists were heading south, I don't believe there was a statewide campaign to encourage that. But clearly there were local FSB sort of chiefs in the North Caucasus who were more or less happy to metaphorically buy these people a plane ticket and wave them on their way, because the sense was it was bleeding away the hungry young radicals who otherwise would be causing trouble at home, and particularly just before Sochi.
Right.
You know, which was a clear state priority. That was all to the good. But they had these sort of glorious thoughts that the Americans basically were going to kill them all. And I did actually have a Russian security officer once complain to me about the Americans not having done a good enough job of killing Russian passport holders, which is interesting, and I suspect not official state policy. But now they are beginning to return, and ironically, the more Islamic State gets hit in Iraq and Syria, and obviously particularly in Iraq, then the more it encourages people to come back. And this is going to be a new generation that they are, firstly, obviously sort of more battle-hardened and radicalized. Secondly, they have been fighting in probably multi-ethnic units, multi-ethnic Russian-speaking units, which means they already come with more kind of cross-national alliances than before, because the Jamaats in the North Caucasus frankly tend to stay within their own ethnic community much more. So this is going to be, I think, a really serious problem. And I think, you know, the Russians are aware of it and are worried. But in some ways, they're stuck now with the long term costs of an earlier policy.
Now, another point others have made is that by injecting itself into the Syrian civil war and essentially into a sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shiites, the Russia's basically made itself a target of choice. It's almost replacing America as target number one. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's an element of that, to be sure. And certainly we see all kinds of blood-curdling rhetoric coming, particularly from Islamic State, but not exclusively, about Russia and about the importance of strikes. But to be honest, I mean, given that Islamic State is already entrenched within sort of parts of the North Caucasus as well as within some Central Asian populations, Russia would anyway be part of the sort of the satanic opposition. And on the whole, people with Russian passports are going to go back to Russia. That's where they're going to carry out their attacks. I don't think it's that otherwise they'd be sitting there thinking, how can I get an H-2B and go over to America and bomb something up? So, yes, it certainly has changed the rhetorical tone. But in practical terms, these guys were coming back to Russia anyway, and they were unlikely to come back just to settle back into real life.
Mm-hmm. So you do see the threat of a wave of a new wave of terror hitting Russia, because it's been kind of quiet for a few years now.
Yeah, sadly, I do. I think this is it. Anyway, they bought that quiet precisely at the cost of what's now facing them.
Uh-huh. Don, what do you think about the returning jihadists, Russia being injected into a sectarian conflict, becoming a target?
Yeah, I wouldn't overestimate it, but I do think it's the case. I think you're right. And I have the sense, and Mark knows more about this than I do, that the security services are not really adjusting effectively so far. Mm-hmm. They're catching up, and we see a fall, the cost of not catching up this week.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is all happening as the Kremlin is preparing for what they hoped would be a very triumphant electoral season, where they would coronate the Tsar with a massive referendum on his wonderful rule. Does this throw a whole wrench in Russia's plans for this political season?
I think that, in a way, Navalny had already done that.
Yes.
I mean, the whole sort of one of the crucial elements of this triumphant coronation was going to be high turnout for the election, because there's been this sort of steady and really quite striking fall in the turnout rates. So precisely, I think they wanted to try and activate youth, and in particular kind of create the sense that this was more of a real election, to create some excitement and such like. I think actually Navalny has been creating a little bit too much excitement from the Kremlin's point of view. So I suspect that if anything, we're going to see probably, sort of obviously in slightly different time frame, but a similar-ish kind of midterm course correction on the campaign that actually we saw in the previous elections. I think they're probably now going to just simply settle for a win, mm-hmm. which, I think I'm willing to put my neck out and actually say I think Putin's going to win this one.
Yeah, go on. Really, you think? And the other thing to consider is, again, like I said earlier, how Navalny's going to play this and how this is going to play into Navalny's plans, right? I mean, does he begin resurrecting the nationalist card again at the risk of alienating the liberal supporters he picked up? Don, last thought to you before we shift gears.
Yeah, I've even actually seen a couple comments from Russian officials about the postponement of elections thing, which is sort of a barometer of how worried they are. And I don't think it will happen, but certainly the factors the two of you gentlemen have talked about suggest that they're not, they'll settle for a big win, and the high turnout just probably is not going to happen the way that it is.
Right. Okay, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion, look at the escalating conflict between Russia and the West in Syria, and at Moscow's efforts to convince Western powers to join it in an international campaign against terrorism. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Foreign Policy Analysis. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
США нанесли ракетный удар по Сирии. Путин называет его противозаконным.
Эти удары нанесли вред делу борьбы с
террором. Грубым, явным и ничем не обоснованным нарушением.
Удары по Сирии – агрессии против суверенного государства.
The week began with a terrorist attack in St. Petersburg, and it ended with U.S. missile strikes against Syria that were condemned by Russia. And in between, a chemical weapons attack in Syria shocked the world. In addition to seeking to use this week's attacks to change the subject at home, the Kremlin also appeared to be hoping that it will change the international conversation as well, pushing issues like the war in Ukraine and Moscow's meddling in Western elections off the agenda. Shortly after the attack, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said it illustrated the importance of stepping up efforts to combat this evil. But at the same time, the Kremlin is under increased international criticism for its actions in Syria and its support for Bashar al-Assad, which many claim is exacerbating the threat of terrorism. Despite overwhelming evidence, Russia continues to insist that Assad was not responsible for this week's chemical weapons attack. And Moscow has condemned the U.S. missile strikes on an airbase in Syria. It has also suspended an agreement with the United States aimed at preventing mid-air incidents. Mark, you had a hot take on this in your blog today. What are your thoughts on this? Because initially my thoughts were, here we go. Moscow's going to really, really ramp it up here and push for this Western coalition against terrorism. The ground is going to be fertile. Then we had the chemical weapons attack in Syria. Then we had Moscow denying it was Assad when it obviously was. Then we had the criticism of Russia for defending Assad. We have the airstrikes now. We have Russia and the U.S. at loggerheads in Syria. Where do you see this going?
Well, let me make one general point first. I mean, what's interesting is this has really illustrated something. We have a tendency in the West, because we're aware of the limits on our own capacities to shape the world, to overplay the extent to which Putin and Russia have been evil geniuses, able to kind of create all these situations. Now we actually see that in the face of events and stuff happening, if you don't mind me getting technical, actually Russia too often is forced in a very reactive mode and actually does not have things go its way. So, I mean, in this case, I mean, look, I'm still perplexed as to whether or not this was something that the Assad regime had carefully talked through with Moscow. And if so, what on earth was Moscow doing, saying, yes, fair enough, go start gassing people with sarin? Or whether it's just simply a case in point that actually your proxies and your clients are often not as much in your control than you might think. But the point is, where does it go from here? Well, the answer is, frankly, it illustrated the relative impotence of Russia, that it cannot do anything to stop America from projecting power when it wants to. Yes, in theory, it could have deployed its surface-to-air missiles that it's placed there, which can attack cruise missiles. But even so, even if it had, it wouldn't have been able to stop all 50. They don't have 50 ready missiles kind of deployable. And so they just sat back and let the Americans pound the Syrians. There'd been this kind of cooperation to make sure that the Russians weren't actually in the target zone, we assume. But that's it. When it comes down to it, actually, Russia has relatively few strategic options. This is really going to be driven by the Americans.
Don, would you agree with that? Is the Americans back in the driver's seat in the Middle East?
I wouldn't say driver's seat, but I found the whole Kremlin reaction overnight extremely interesting. This is Trump is a man, after all, they had a man crush on until January, and all of a sudden he's bombing their adversaries. I found I'm trying to resist a comment about Obama's policy on Syria, but it very much exposes the impotence or the lack of real clout that Russia has in the region. And we tend to exaggerate his genius. I absolutely agree. We tend to exaggerate the Kremlin's cleverness. And I think they were very quite surprised by what happened here. And you saw the reaction today. This is their partner, Donald Trump. And it just doesn't seem to be happening the way that it turned out. And if the U.S. seeks to become more permanently engaged, I think it's going to have major consequences for Russian foreign policy in the region.
I mean, are we now at the risk, though, of engagement between American and Russian forces? This is something that's been raised. If the U.S. is going to become more active in Syria with Russian with Russian boots on the ground, so to speak, or at least planes in the air, what does that mean there? Is there a risk?
Yeah, there's always a risk, but I mean, these conversations go on all the time about coordinating activity. I didn't see the time difference between the. I assume the Russians were told last night that the U.S. is going to do that.
Yes.
I don't know how many minutes before it happened. I mean, I think this is for a Russian leadership that really wants to be in control there and have the initiative. This is now, in many ways, just gone up in smoke because you don't know what Trump will do next. And it could really, really adversely affect the Kremlin calculus.
Well, no, this surprised a lot of people. And, Mark, I can't help but go back to discussions we had very early after Trump's election that Putin just got himself his own very own Putin, his very own unpredictable actor that's going to do things that he doesn't expect and doesn't want. Has this basically exposed the emperor has no clothes here in Moscow?
Yeah, but also exactly this is Moscow's nightmare again. They have always been able to rely on American predictability, allowing them to play the unpredictable card. Now that America is unpredictable, this is really why I think they behind the scenes they were concerned about Trump from the beginning because they had no idea, as it were, who Trump was. And the dawning realization that what Trump stands for today need not be what he stands for tomorrow, meaning that you actually have very, very sort of few clear senses of where the limits are. I think that really brings things to a whole new level for the Russians. And I think it's worth saying, look, there's very little sense at this stage that America plans to actually intervene much more sort of concretely in Syria in this kind of whole boots on the ground sort of level. The virtue of cruise missiles as an instrument of state, precisely that they are standoff weapons, that you can just send your $15 million worth of Tomahawk missiles at something, deliver a message, and let's be honest, this was more about messaging than it was just degrading Syrian air power or anything like that, but that it doesn't actually bring any long-term consequences for you in the sense of you hadn't then got forces stuck in a morass or whatever. So the irony is, in real terms, the situation in Syria today is pretty much what it was yesterday.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes, the Syrians have lost presumably depots of chemical weapons. Yes, their air power has taken a certain hit. But in grand terms, nothing has changed militarily, but everything has changed politically. And again, the question that is now being posed to Moscow is, at a time with all these other challenges, how far are you really willing to go to bank for Assad? I mean, how far is Assad every bit as toxic as his chemicals?
Mm. Don, what's the sense in Washington? Is this a one-off, or are we expecting to see an escalation in U.S. involvement in Syria?
I think it's to be determined. It's too early to talk about, have a chattering class come to any firm conclusions about that. The New York Times and Post coverage this morning was remarkably distant from supporting Trump, I thought. But can I go back to Trump as a president? I mean, this is a guy who last week appeared to indicate that they were going to tolerate Assad in power. And now he's done essentially what is a humanitarian intervention in some ways. Mm. And if that's what Trump is going to do, this is a real, real scary thing for Moscow, I would think. Because he was supposed to be the consummate realist, and it turns out maybe he's not. And as we've talked about, all three of us have talked about, I think they're very, very nervous and now somewhat alarmed about what happened.
I wanted to pick up on something Mark just said about where on one hand, the militarily today, we're at the same place we were yesterday, but politically everything has changed. If this is a one-off. And if the Syrian civil war continues as it has been, and if Russia continues doing what it does and Assad continues doing what he does, how has anything changed politically?
Well, my view is that it's not as straightforward as just simply saying, as long as you don't use chemical weapons, everything is going to be fine. What I think this has demonstrated is two things. One is that, and it shouldn't need to be demonstrated, but it does, that the United States has got the capacity to deploy fairly massive, overwhelming force. But secondly, it is that Trump cannot be predicted. It is that today it was a chemical attack, fine. And one could suggest that in some ways this actually is Trump being realistic rather than humanitarian, because this demonstrates, this shows that he is, not uncaring about gassed children. It shows that he is not, Putin's puppet. It ticks a whole variety of domestic political boxes as well. Who knows quite where the imperative came from. But what happens next time? Next time there are barrel bombings of schools. Might there happen to be particularly poignant TV images that trigger another response? The Russians just don't know. And we don't know, and Trump doesn't know. I mean, I think this is the thing. Actually, it is a question whereby I think up to a certain point, up to now, and certainly under the previous presidency, the Russians had a clear sense of basically what they could get away with, and in a way that they could prosecute their war up to that point. And that was a fairly generous, as we saw with the capacity to get away with the massive indiscriminate bombing and shelling of Aleppo, fairly generous rules of engagement that they could get away with. Now I think that they really don't know. And again, I think we should be aware that in terms of planning, you always think worst case. The Russians have to think worst case about what Trump might be agitated by tomorrow.
Yeah, no, trying to think that through it could be anything, actually. Don, would you agree with that?
I would very much agree. It would be very interesting to see what the tone, not just the content, is of the Tillerson meeting next week in Moscow, because he has been under severe criticism in a lot of quarters for being relatively ineffective, and there are a lot of people in the State Department whose jobs are still open. But it would be very interesting to see how this works now after what happened last night.
And in another thing is, a lot of people are expecting the content of that conversation to be about Russian election meddling in the United States, and now the content of that conversation is probably going to be a little bit different from that. I found it really striking that the early in the week, Putin got something he always wanted from China. He got a phone call and the condolences for the attacks and said, we need to fight this together, right? If you look at the readout from the Trump-Putin phone call. The week ended with Trump bombing Putin's ally. What are we to make of this? Are Russian-American relations going back to the kind of neo-Cold War-ish default that they were already in? Is the ambiguity now gone? Mark, what do you think?
I think in some ways, look, America's policy towards Russia hasn't actually changed. What we have seen is the kind of the superstructure of rhetoric has changed in recent months, which kind of raised all kind of concerns in some camps, optimism in others, that precisely there was going to be something much more substantive. But, foreign policy is notoriously pragmatic once you strip away a lot of the kind of the rhetoric and human interactions. In this context, we've always been in this situation that basically Russia's geostrategic goals are not really in keeping with US or even just generally Western interests. Russia is engaged in supporting some particularly malevolent practices and regimes, and Russia has strikingly little to offer. Even if we talk about counterterrorism cooperation, I mean, at the moment, if anything, the lesson of St. Petersburg is not actually that the Russians are the people whom we are desperate to rely on for advice and guidance and inside gen. They had to rely on the Kyrgyz security apparatus for this. And that's why I think a general pattern that we're seeing with the Central Asian challenge is exactly that they're having to basically rely on information that they're getting from their Central Asian partners. So, I mean, in this context, what this has really just demonstrated is the underlying reality of the relationship beneath all the fluff and the glitz that we've seen in recent months, I would say.
Don, what's the sense in Washington now? Is all talk of a potential Trump-Putin reset off the table? How is this playing, given the whole atmosphere with the multiple investigations into the election?
Oh, there's been a market hardening almost by the day. I think that the chances of a grand bargain, which we used to hear about a lot in December, are absolutely gone. And the choices of the Russia policymakers around Trump show that. They're all pretty tough. And I think the most central driving issue, though, has been the investigation and into Russian meddling. I think there's very little chance of the kind of good relationship people thought of so 8, 9, 10 weeks ago. I think the Trump factor, though, is an interesting thing to watch because this Marxist superstructure, this relationship will now take place with a president who is at the minimum unpredictable. And I think that is going to really make life difficult for Moscow. I think Trump's inconsistency and unpredictability in a way is a foreign policy asset because Moscow really doesn't know what to make of it. If you look at their response overnight, which is what to suspend the consultation about military activities, that's a very, very, very weak response to what's a very serious military action by the United States. And it goes to the point Mark said, which is that, you know, there's an asymmetry of interests, an asymmetry of strategic visions, and there's an asymmetry just of the way that both sides can cooperate on some of these issues. Russia, in many ways, has very little to offer us except to make trouble, and they're pretty good at that. I think that's going to continue.
All right, and we're bumping up against it now. Mark, last thoughts to you before we wrap it up for the week.
I think, actually, last thought is we haven't really talked about the military dimension here. How the military, the Russian military, see what's happened in Syria. And again, I think it's worth noting that there's always been a debate or divide between them, as in those people who talk up American capacities because they look at the sort of the technical dimension, and those people who have tended to discount it on the basis of the political dimension. In a way, that the view of it doesn't matter how many teeth the other side has got if they're not going to bite you. Well, I think what we've now seen precisely is that the capacity and the will to bite have come together. And again, just from a morning's worth of surfing a few sites and talking to a couple of people, very much get the sense that the military is now in a more cautious mode, especially certainly as regards Syria. That from their point of view, they have always been, ironically enough, amongst the conservative elements in policy because they know what the Americans can do. And now they're saying, you see, it's not just can do, but will do.
My last thoughts, if you think back to last week's podcast when we were looking at the protests and the Navalny report, it seems we've gone through a couple of weeks where this regime's aura of omnipotence was pierced at home. And now we just went through a week where their aura of omnipotence was pierced abroad as well. And one has to wonder what that means going forward as we go into what's going to be a very, very important political season in Russia. So on that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official, a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a hiatus next week due to the Easter holiday. We'll be back in action on April 21st. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.